Welcome to this session of SAA's 2012 annual meeting, session 601, using Archon and Archivist Toolkit to become more participatory. I am Cliff Hite, and I'm the chair of this session. And first of all, we would like to say thanks for attending. We know it's a Saturday. There might be other things to do in San Diego than listen to us, but we appreciate you being here. Hopefully we can make it worth your while. We'd also ask that you would kindly mute or turn off your cell phones, so in case important calls come to you, they don't disrupt anybody else around you. Although, if you want to tweet about our session, you may need to leave your phone on. You can follow our hashtag at the bottom if you want to tweet about us. We also encourage questions, but ask that you hold them until the end of the session so that we can get through the presentation portion, and then we'll hopefully have some decent amount of time for questions. So one of the first questions is, why does our topic matter? Well, the concept of participatory archives is our profession's addition to the ever-increasing participatory culture trend that has been developing over the past 5 to 10 years. To gauge its popularity, how many times this week have we heard terms like citizen archivist, community archives, crowdsourcing, or collaborative archives? These developments mean that we need collection management tools that can assist us in becoming participatory archives, hence our inclusion of AT and Archon users who are making these efforts. And we also recognize that often we need a level of institutional capacity to garner participation with the right groups in ways that allow us to keep our heads above water. If we stretch beyond our means by trying to do too much with too little, we may end up with too many half-done online projects that are worse than a few successfully administered quality efforts. So our approach to this session is for users of Archon and AT to describe what they are doing to become participatory. I will discuss how Archon is helping us build capacity by streamlining workflows and improving public access. Jay Trask will share how Archon is helping him partner with others on campus. Kyle Remkes will share how he was using Archon to build a collaborative archive. Then we're going to switch tools, and Jillian Cuellar will discuss how she is training graduate students to use AT as an essential aspect of efficient archival processing by training graduate students to use it. I missed that part. And then Chris Irvin will share a case study of using AT to enhance reference services. Holly Mingle will explain the use of AT in the PacSchool project. And Chris Prom, in the voice and form of Kyle, since Chris has obligations in Illinois and could not be with us today, he'll share how the upcoming blend of Archon and Archivist Toolkit, Archive Space, is striving for greater participatory options. And finally, Max Evans will comment with an alternative view of how his institution is making its systems work better together. As far as walkaways from this session, we plan for attendees, which would be all of you, to learn how others are using Archon and Archivist Toolkit. We also hope that you can pick up some ideas for how to use these tools to become participatory in your unique situations, and also have some hope that if we can do this, so can you. So my portion is directed mainly towards folks who are considering using Archon or who have recently started using it. When I arrived in March of 2011, we had limited accession information in one word processing document with paper files giving greater detail. And then in separate locations, we had descriptions that were in multiple formats. And then in an additional different location, we had location information about where to find those collections. We weren't using DACs, and we had been under restores. We had one archivist, who was a Herculean archivist, by the way, who was overseeing the archives and manuscripts, which totaled about 14,000 linear feet. We had four paraprofessionals who were assisting with various aspects of the job, whether it's processing, reference, digitization, or other components. And then we had 3 to 4 student assistants. And the finding aids were in HTML and legacy formats, Word, WordPerfect, paper, and other varieties. And at the time, the workflow was to create the finding these descriptions in Word, review them and finalize them, convert them to WordPerfect, and then convert them to HTML. And I'll show you an example of one of our HTML finding aids. And as you can see from this one, This was a what I've heard termed mullet processed description, which is short in the front with the front matter, but long in the back with the inventory. And I can't take credit for originating that term. Sasha Griffin from Luther College had blogged about it, and Sherry Berger at CDL had spoken about it at SAA last year. If you guys want a further etymology, I could give you the full one later on if you're interested. So we recognized that we needed help, and we needed something that could do, that could give us improved collection management that in relational ways could connect the accession, location, and description information. We needed improved workflows to reduce the number of steps between accessioning and publishing descriptions to the web. And we needed improved access, public access, with broader representation of our holdings in ways that would interact effectively with our library's discovery tool and other programs. We wanted it to be web-based. For example, I can make changes here, 1,500 miles from our repository. And we also wanted a program that we wouldn't be tied to forever, so that we could transition to the next big thing, whether it's archive space or some other tool. So we selected Archon because it almost completely met the list of wants in a collection management system that our department staff compiled. We then adopted DAX, and after some discussion with department faculty and staff, we created institutional templates that matched these DAX elements with fields in Archon. And a side benefit of this is that our data now can more easily be contributed with Archon's EAD and EACCPF export functionalities to any consortial opportunities that may arise. And we can point to Archon as an integral tool that helps us improve collection management and assists with organizing our personnel resources to address our backlog and improve accessibility. Now, I have to give a disclaimer as I talk about the benefits of implementing Archon, that there is not a direct correlation between implementing Archon and personnel growth. Yet, we currently sit with 3 professionals in our department, with 4.5 paraprofessionals and about 6 student assistants. So with the likelihood of adding 2 more professionals in the next 6 to 8 months and possibly 1 more paraprofessional in the next year or so, the benefit of these additional people is that we'll have more time to be able to input descriptions, to interact with potential donors, to assist with reference services, and handle other duties in the repository. But more relevant to participatory archives, our improved collection management should free some of our personnel to connect more effectively with users, creators, and others as we figure out how our organizational culture will best allow these groups to participate in archival endeavors. Some of the possibilities include ideas that have been discussed in earlier sessions during this conference and some that will be discussed more fully by later panelists. Things like building a pattern of creators contributing some descriptive information elements, using graduate or undergraduate students in subject specializations to assist processing specific holdings, crowdsourcing photo identification, or indexing handwritten or typed digitized materials. Ultimately, we plan to build on the participatory foundation that has been laid both in our institution and in our profession to provide as much access as we can and to harness the knowledge and interest of others to assist in the process.
All right, similar to what Cliff just discussed, I want to focus on the early stages of an Archon implementation project that I see will eventually result in creating a more participatory environment for our users. However, before reaching out to the outside world, to the users out there, I felt that I needed to reach out to the fellows within my academic library system itself. The archival program needs to be seen as an integral part of the library and its mission, something which I felt wasn't necessarily the case at my institution, particularly because a lot of the librarians and others saw us as kind of mysterious and they didn't actually know what we did. The journey towards implementation of Archon helped establish important relationships with other departments within the library, and particularly resulted in increased collaboration with both our technical services department and our instructional services department. And it actually helped kind of alleviate some of that fear of archives that some people seem to have. And I see these partnerships as laying important groundwork for wider participation for our users in the future, with such simple methods as just actually making things discoverable and improving access to the materials that we have, and for it becoming an active part of our instruction program. So before we move on, I just want to quickly give you a quick introduction to the University of Northern Colorado. We're not North Carolina. We're the other UNC out west. We're a medium-sized institution in Greeley, Colorado. We're the third largest university in Colorado. And we began as a normal school, which is actually relevant because it's the teaching focus that the normal schools had is still very important to the campus and particularly important for our library. We define ourselves as a teaching library. Archival services, however, had kind of remained rather hidden for years. People just didn't know who we were, didn't know what we did. So I wanted us to become, you know, a very active part of the library community. So archival services, we kind of are what we collect in some ways. Just a quick note of what we do collect. We're the official home of the university records, the James A. Michener papers. And then for us, special collections, which is kind of a nebulous term that includes absolutely everything else, ranging from records of flowers to books. So we do have great stuff, but our discovery was really, really limited. We had a wide variety of finding aids for each of the separate collecting areas. Each of the finding aids was done in a different way, a different format. When people actually came to look at the finding aids, they encountered just kind of a list with no description of what the material was. And furthermore, all of these finding aids ranged widely in format, ranging from the scanned pieces of paper that were turned into PDF to PDF documents to Word documents. We had a few documents that were actually done in EAD, but it was very few and far between. And furthermore, what was worse is we actually had no inventory list, no kind of location shelf guide, so everything was just kind of hidden in the back. So it was abundantly clear that we needed an archival content management system. We needed something that could kind of bring order to the chaos that we had, something that could manage our inventory and facilitate discovery. So my primary goal was that I wanted users to be able to discover materials, but I also wanted us to be able to find materials. And additionally, I really saw this as an opportunity to promote the archives and to ensure that I had buy-in from my colleagues and my superiors within the library. I wanted them to understand how exciting our collections were and what we could do to actually serve the greater good of the library. So I worked with my dean to pull together an advisory group of several different people from departments throughout the library, including folks from administration, folks from technical services, folks from IT, digital initiatives, to look at different archival content management system options. Just as many others found out, they were a little intimidated by archives. So the first part of the project was just working with them to identify archival fundamentals, what we had, what archive terms actually meant. And I felt that if librarians could be intimidated by archival jargon, I needed to make sure not to use that for our students. So the group was formed, and after considerable discussion and education, we actually all took the SAA webinar on archival content management systems. We selected Archon that was best to fit our needs. And I wanted the advisory group to expand to include somebody from instructional services because, as I mentioned earlier, we are a teaching library, so I wanted to make sure people would know that it was for teaching. So the group expanded. This allowed opportunities for actual hands-on work from people within the advisory group. Technical services department sent paraprofessionals to the archives who were in need of work, and our paraprofessionals were able to work on these legacy finding aids. What I did is I had education sessions for them. I taught them the archival fundamentals. I invited others into this session to learn about what we did in archives. I invited the entire library, actually. We had 15 to 20 of our total staff of 50 come in to learn about archives. Additionally, we worked with the instructional services people to make sure that these tools would be usable for our undergraduate students and for them as well. We created a LibGuide, which is a guide that's a resource, a reference guide for folks, specifically for Archon, so that people could use. And Cliff has pointed out my time is up, so I need to... close up, and which is kind of nice. I was going to have pictures of Archon. Our Archon implementation has actually gone down. My IT guy hasn't fixed it yet. It's not an Archon problem. It's a UNC problem. So thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. I am Kyle Rimkus, Preservation Librarian at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I'm going to talk to you today about a project that I worked on in my previous position at the University of Miami in Florida called the Collaborative Archive from the African Diaspora, or the CAD. It defines itself as a shared archive of manuscripts, oral histories, images, books, a number of things, and other ephemera documenting African American and black history, culture, and experiences in South Florida and other Florida destinations and the Caribbean. And all records in the CAD represent collections that can be accessed in South Florida archives, libraries, and cultural heritage institutions. The idea for this project really began when a number of librarians and archivists at the University of Miami realized that there was great interest in the topic of the history of black communities in South Florida from students and scholars, but no one really knew what was out there as far as primary materials were concerned or how to access them. And we'd also heard anecdotally that some places that people knew had stuff weren't being very open with providing access. So we were curious about what we could do to improve that situation. We had adopted Archon in 2007 across our three archival repositories and had introduced the MPLP, more product, less process, methodology for archival description. I don't want to belabor this point, but I just want to say that the process of introducing a common methodology across all of our repositories and a common software really helped give us a notion of what it would take to do something similar outside the walls of our institution. But we knew that this would come with certain other complications, and we really drew certain inspiration for how we wanted to do this from this concept of community archives. For example, I would refer you to the Plateau People's Web Portal, which, according to its website, aims to create not just a digital portal to view content, but also a different paradigm for the curation, distribution, and reproduction of Native people's cultural materials. So these community archives are motivated by the concept of distributed ownership of content, that you could have a digital archive of material that isn't necessarily owned by the people who are running the archive. So we tried to apply this concept to the CAD. We were able to recruit 8 local institutions in South Florida. We conducted extensive outreach and education to those places, set up an Archon instance for the CAD, produced a manual for how to apply the more product, less process approach, and also did quite a bit of on-site outreach in terms of collection management practices. And as a result, we currently have a site with 8 repositories, only 38 collection records, so finding aid records, from some institutions that didn't have archival management systems in place before. And while it hasn't necessarily become at this point the vast scholarly resource that we think it might become one day, I think the first step has really been made in terms of establishing relationships with other archives and building trust in the community. So you may be wondering, is Archon a good platform for this sort of a project? And we found that it was. Archon is natively multi-tenant. By that I mean that you can have multiple repositories in one instance of Archon. It's web-based, which helps to allow us to support people who are using it in geographically distributed locations. It's very easy to learn and to use. And most importantly, it empowers users to decide which of their finding aids they're going to publish and when. They don't have to go through a gatekeeper to publish their finding aids or their digital content. The one weakness that I would point out that we ran into in several instances was that you couldn't always export one record out of Archon and import it into another instance of Archon without some content loss. So that turned out to be a problem when certain institutions had their own instances of Archon and wanted to contribute records to the site. So that was my brief crash course introduction to what we were doing with the CAD. This is my contact information, but if you're interested in the project itself, I would refer you to Beatrice Skokin at the University of Miami, who's listed below. Thank you.
Good afternoon. If you've read this month's issue of Archival Outlook, then you should already know that I'm the new head of the Center for Primary Research and Training at UCLA Library Special Collections. The purpose of the CFPRT is to find graduate students with specific subject expertise and train them to process archival collections that match up with their research interests. Every quarter, we hire graduate students from a wide variety of disciplines. Most of these students are completely new to archives. They are chosen to participate in the CFPRT based on their knowledge as scholars, but perhaps more importantly, based on their sincere desire to learn about archival work. By inviting grad students to join us at the processing table, they switch roles from users of archives to co-creators of archives and contribute to scholarship from the other side of the reference desk. In other words, the CFPRT is the ultimate example of participatory archives, and our students actually get paid to do it. UCLA Library Special Collections began implementing use of the Archivist Toolkit for some aspects of collection management in 2010. However, this summer quarter is the first time that all CFPRT students are required to use the AT to create finding aids. I first began training graduate students to use the Archivist Toolkit in 2009 as an archivist at NYU. A common response to the AT was, and I'm sure that this will sound familiar to many of you, this program sucks. Can I use a Word doc or spreadsheet and maybe just import it later? Students saw the AT as an archaic program that was making their work more difficult rather than more efficient. At that point, I realized that these students, all of whom were new to the profession, had no concept of all of the mechanisms and processes archivists developed to make finding aids available and fully searchable online in the absence of a program like the Archivist Toolkit. So when I set out to train graduate students at UCLA, I made it a point to begin at the beginning, the very beginning. I start by showing them how archivists provided access to collections through the creation of paper finding aids. We talk about how researchers located archival collections before the advent of the web and online search tools. We also talk about how the archives profession lacked a standardized finding aid structure and the difficulties that presented for producing machine-readable finding aids. Then, before we even open the AT, I give them a brief overview of how EAD came into existence. I know that this sounds really boring, but I've been really surprised at how interested they are in learning about this. I should note here that I'm really lucky that all of the students I'm working with this summer have good, solid tech skills and are extremely comfortable with computers and learning new software. Most of them have basic HTML skills. Some of them are even familiar with XML. But for the large majority of these students, the AT is a program that they will never use again. Frankly, it would be very easy for me to skip this history lesson and just show them the basic steps to creating a multi-generational family and be done with it. But that approach is not my preferred style of training, and besides, that would be out of line with the purpose of the CFPRT. I want students to walk away from their experience in special collections with a solid understanding of the fundamentals of archival practice. And that includes a basic familiarity with EAD, its relationship to XML, how it's different from HTML, and how using EAD enables us to make our finding aids fully searchable and networked within and across institutions through online search tools. We talk hierarchy, code, tags, and attributes, and we look at the various methods institutions have employed to encode new and legacy finding aids and all of the work and skill that went into developing those methods. And then we log into the AT. You can imagine how much excitement has built up to this moment. We go over the basics of how the AT is set up, and I point out how AT fields correspond to EAD tags and how those both map to DAX. And by this time, believe it or not, they are totally on board with using it. Sure, they probably have the technical skills to learn how to hand encode their finding aids. Maybe some of them would even enjoy doing that. But once they see how easy the AT makes it to export EAD, they understand why we use it. Some of them actually describe this experience as exciting. The student has no idea how much she made my day by sending me this email. This kind of reaction is my goal, to get students to appreciate the AT as much as I do, not necessarily for its interface, but for its ability to make our collections available much more efficiently. At this point, I emphasize to students that it's not just that AT does the work of encoding finding aids for us. It's also that AT enables us to manage our collections more efficiently as an institution. And that allows us to devote more time to things like arrangement and robust description. And that's when we really start delving into DACs, but that's an acronym for another lightning session. Thanks.
Good afternoon. I'm Chris Irvin. I'm very happy to be here with you. I'll be presenting the results of a collaborative effort between a reference archivist, me, and a research historian. I'll demonstrate how taking a deeper dive in delivering reference services can result in a greater understanding of and access to data hidden in collections. For this study, the reference request from documentary historian Dennis Casebeer, his collections form the basis of the Mojave Desert Archives. The geographic footprint of the archives area of interest is in the desert regions of southeastern California, outlined in green. Within this footprint lies the Mojave National Preserve, and within it, the project area of our reference request, Landfair Valley, a well-watered, high desert basin that was the site of intense homesteading 100 years ago. Mr. Casebeer is currently developing a historical monograph on the area. The reference request posed by the historian was, what can a graphical analysis of the homestead data tell us about settlement patterns? To answer this question, the reference archivist must transform text data into a graphical representation. Here's a stub of the initial data set. It was obtained many years ago from the National Archives and input into WordPerfect by the historian. This format is repeated 155 times, once for each homestead's land patent. This format did not lend itself to manipulation and needed to be transformed into something easier to work with. Transforming the data for migration into a database required several substeps. The WordPerfect data was brought into the 21st century by using the built-in converter in Word, and then consistent data formatting was manually enforced. Saving the file as plain text then stripped out Word's hidden characters, and care was taken to avoid eliminating any desired content. Now the data was starting to resemble something that could be imported into a database. The data received one last manual cleansing of any imperfections. The text file could now be opened in an Excel spreadsheet, our ersatz database of choice. The number of columns was reduced to a handful of key data elements selected for graphing. I screwed up the slides there. My apologies. So with the data loaded in a database, it was sorted by entry date and input into Archivist Toolkit in original order. To support future reference inquiries, a processing note was added to maintain a linkage between the record and its graphical representation. We selected an appropriate canvas for visual representation, a 1920s era U.S. Geological Survey map of Landfair Valley, found in the archives. The map was scanned into a vector graphics program and grid lines were added to aid precision. Legal descriptions from the land patents were used to plot the parcels onto the map. Each parcel is numbered so it can be traced back to the homestead data entered into AT. The land entries are grouped by year and allow us to see any settlement patterns that might emerge. These annual snapshots were ordered like frames in a film strip. When played back, they become a kind of movie. Now let's put the whole thing in motion. Ladies and gentlemen, a quarter century of homestead settlement data in Landfair Valley. So it feels like there should be some organ swell here. So these visual results were shared with the historian and to fulfill the reference request. Ancillary observations of the data trends were obtained and provided as an added bonus. For example, it became clear that over the 25-year period, there were three waves of settlement. Explaining the factors behind this phenomenon is gratefully left to the historian. So to ensure we captured the output for future use, we added the link to the graphics file in the ATIA sessions record. An unconventional documentation method, but it works. So to conclude, an in-depth collaboration between research historian and reference archivist can reinforce traditional bonds while at the same time enriching the cultural record. The transformation of data into a visual representation increased our understanding of existing collections and focused our thinking for inputting existing materials into AT. And finally, the output of new digital materials can be folded back into AT to augment future reference inquiries. Thank you very much.
Hello. I'm here to talk about the Pascal Hidden Collections Processing Project, but in the grand tradition of grant funding, I'm on my third job since I was asked to talk at this session. However, in each of my positions, we have or are using Archivist Toolkit to place content online and in the hands of the users. The Pascal Hidden Collections Processing Project's grant funding sadly ended in March of this year. Our goal was to process 125 collections and update 75 legacy finding aids using the Archivist Toolkit, which resulted in 200 collections from 25 institutions, large and small, which were previously inaccessible and are now available on a single finding aid site. Not only are these finding aids available, but repositories which did not previously have Archivist Toolkit or create online finding aids now have a method to upload their existing and new finding aids. As a result, there are now more than 600 finding aids on a single site that utilizes faceted searching. This makes the Pascal Finding Aids site an ideal first place for researchers to begin looking for Philadelphia-based materials. While the Finding Aids site, which was developed by and hosted by the University of Pennsylvania, does not make user participation part of its inner workings, the Hidden Collections team created an active blog which connected the reactions of our student processors to the collections with the Finding Aids and had, by the end of the project, more than 10,000 unique visitors. This is where our collection users made their own information known. These users included people who knew the collection's creators or people who were experts on specific subject matter. Many people commented regarding the finding aids, which allowed us to revise our description and make the finding aids more accurate. User participation is particularly important for this project, as well as, I think, for most grant-funded projects. In the Pascal Hidden Collections project, our processors usually worked at 1 to 3 of the 25 participating repositories, and at each one processed 7 to 10 collections. At repositories like the Wagner Free Institute of Science, the Independent Seaport Museum, or the Philadelphia Museum of Art, collections generally related to at least a broad subject matter. However, at other repositories, like the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, collections were completely unrelated. Our processors there worked with Colonial Philadelphia Records, a collection of family papers spanning 5 generations of transportation companies' records, and World War II material. After the Pascal grant finished, I worked very briefly on another CLEAR grant, the Promoting Research Through Rare Book Cataloging Partnerships at the University of Pennsylvania. My supervisor there had a pile of non-book printed material stuff, which he was dreading working with because it just did not really work with traditional processing or cataloging. And so she brought me in to teach her catalogers how to use Archivist Toolkit, and we used my 2 months there for intensive experimentation. In a similar manner to the Pascal project, one cataloger could not possibly be an expert on all the non-book material. Again, and therefore, the blog that we created was, again, an opportunity for user participation. And in fact, we actively solicited help creating blog posts called Conundrum of the Week, in which we asked those with information to comment. Probably the best example of our need for help is the collection which we affectionately titled Dutch Things, because for the first several weeks, we really had absolutely no idea what was in it. Neither I nor the project staff spoke Dutch, so I spent a lot of time with Google Translate. But since I frequently came up with translations which were about jam, I was pretty sure that they weren't too accurate. But here's where we think that a Dutch speaker can provide us with information that will greatly improve our description of the material and thus make it more accessible. The final thing I want to talk about is my new job at Princeton. I just started there, so I can't take any credit for the great things that they're doing there, but I'm going to use this opportunity to give my amazing colleagues some well-deserved credit. First off, every one of their collections has an online presence, and two industrious student workers are currently adding container lists to those collections with only a collection-level description. As far as user participation, Princeton has, for many years, used manuscript problems reports to allow researchers to provide corrections, adding information, etc., resulting in an iterative, extensible finding aid process. I'm not sure how long these will continue in existence because Princeton is beta testing its new finding aid site, which contains a comment field. In future, I expect that when those who are using the finding aid will simply add additional information and revisions using this feature. But this site is really awesome, and if you have a chance to check it out and have comments, you should send them to the developers, who I know would be happy to hear from you. And finally, for any of those out there who are thinking about ways to include user knowledge in your improving your finding aids, you don't actually need much time, money, or technical skills to do so. For the PASCO project, a free WordPress blog provided us with what we needed. And time is definitely the most important thing because you'll need to write your blog post, but if you look at it as outreach, it sort of doubles up. So if you have any questions for me following the SAA, please feel free to contact me. Thanks.
Lou, it's me again. Chris Prom was unable to make it to the session today, so he's asked me to deliver his slides, an update on what's going on with archive space. And this is essentially a distillation of what Mark Marienzo and Catherine Cott presented at the Archon Archivist Toolkit roundtable meeting. So for those of you who weren't able to attend that, I hope this will be useful. For those of you who did attend it, please stick around. We have one more speaker who's got a great presentation on the way. So just to give, for those of you who don't know what archive space is, Archon and the Archivist Toolkit are currently going into maintenance mode, which means that no more new releases of those softwares will be made. So, but the principal stakeholders, creators of those platforms, have banded together to create something new called archive space. It's being funded by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, and all the usual suspects are involved, Chris Prom, Scott Schwartz, Brad Westbrook. And in addition to that, there's a new development team that's been brought on to encode the software called Hudson Malonglo. Mark Marienzo is the technical lead on the project, and Catherine Codd is coordinating development. In addition to that, Lyrisys has been chosen as the organizational home for archive space, essentially meaning that they will be responsible for articulating a sustainability plan for developing archive space once this injection of Mellon money runs out. And the actual development process of archive space is proceeding using an agile methodology, meaning that Mark is gathering specifications from the user community of archive space. He's feeding this information to the developers, who are developing in 2-week sprints, and they will be releasing a new version of the archive space code every 2 months. In addition to that, the various people involved in archive space will soon be soliciting user stories from the archive space community of users. These are essentially simple statements of what you want to do with the system so that they can be able to further specify the needs of the software and prioritize them. And archive space itself strives to do all the essential functions that both Archon and the Archivist Toolkit did. But in addition, it'll be more than that, because technical architecture that will be in place will be more flexible, more modular, and more importantly, better scalable to accommodate large finding aids or large collections of finding aids. So to learn more about ArchivesSpace, you can go to archivespace.org. If you want to engage with the community more, you can check out the ArchivesSpace Google group. If you're technically inclined, you can go to the GitHub repository where the source code of ArchivesSpace is freely available, and you can test it out on your own computer. And Chris wanted me to say that he felt that the ArchivesSpace will be built in such a way that does further facilitate participatory projects like the ones being presented in this panel today. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me? Hear me in the back? I'm Max Evans, and I'm here to talk to you about EAD in a world of library systems. We've heard today of using integrated archive systems to help us to be more participatory and collaborative. I will not comment in the few minutes I have on all of this good work. Instead, I will discuss another kind of collaboration we need that's based on certain assumptions. I'll illustrate how these assumptions have led me and my organization to take a different approach. I assume that archival institutions are closely associated with libraries and sometimes with museums. Archives' parent institutions want integration with their library systems because patrons expect to find everything, collections from the library, the archives, and museum all in one place. Library systems are more robust than archive systems, and the library systems market is better developed. Library systems work well for cataloging collections, for discovery, managing physical inventory and circulation, managing and delivering digital objects, and preserving digital objects. But most library systems are not well suited for describing and delivering archival content below the collection level. Therefore, EAD is necessary for granular description and needs to be thought of as a node in a larger network of systems. And we should find ways to leverage existing library system tools to benefit archives. For example, this is where I get into our show and tell. The LDS Church Library uses, along with our own homegrown EAD tool, a suite of Ex Libris Library Systems products. They include Aleph for library archives and museum catalogs, and for collection management and circulation. Primo, the public-facing discovery tool, and Rosetta, the digital collections management system for delivery and for digital records preservation. Now I'll illustrate how this works in our institution. We use Primo to discover the collection and its associated finding aid. I'm going to see if I can get a mouse to work on here and see if you can see it. You see my mouse? So I entered in the search box a call number for a collection that I want and did a search and came up with the result that you see here. And found the collection, the Brigham Young office files. Click here, and that brings up the EAD instance of our finding aid, beginning with the front matter, which goes on for a couple more screenshots. But if you wanted to see the content for it, you click here to browse the collection. The nested components are organized like a media player. I'll select the series, Governor's Office Files, down here somewhere. I can't actually see it, but it takes me to the same place. And that brings up a description of the series over here on the right and a list of all of the sub-series. And I knew that would be too touchy, so I've jumped ahead to the next group, which is a list of sub-series and folders. Click on that one, and you can see that I've zoomed in on what I was trying to show you. Let me go back. I want to illustrate here that wherever you are, you maintain your context graphically through those little yellow markups there. And down at the bottom, you can't see it, but there's a path statement that gives a textual representation of the of where you're located. So context is maintained. Let me zoom in and show you some of the services that we provide here. One simple one here is a citation that a user can cut and paste and use any way they want. Down here, you'll see that you've got container information, and instead of writing out your call slip, we will be developing a means of placing a paging request here with a request button at this point. Or you can request digitization, and this is live today, and that moves into a form the metadata from the EAD component. The user completes the contact information, and then on submit, we review their request. And I got to get this right. They criticized me for not getting this right when I did this before at work. So when the request is granted, after it's submitted, granted, paid for, and the digitization request is completed. That's a phrase I had to ask because everybody said, this is going to be automatic. No, it's not. It's going to take some time. But when that happens, then that digitization request button is replaced with a thumbnail, as you can see here, indicating that the folder here, the component, has been digitized. And if you click on the thumbnail, it takes you to Ex Libris's Rosetta, their collections digital asset management system, and you can navigate using the structure map here on the left, or you can use the front and back buttons over here. So you can navigate through this thing in that way. So that's a quick tour of what we're doing with our EAD tool. What's next? Integration with Aleph Circulation System, as I showed you. Pipes from the Aleph bib record to populate much of the overview. Our staff is getting awfully tired of putting the same data in both places. And something that I think is most exciting, and that is integration with Primo. The ability to harvest component metadata for direct discovery. To show you how that would work, this is a mock-up, so this isn't live yet. But if I did a search, as you can see, for 19th century Mormon church leader George Q. Cannon, I'd get this result. I've limited the set to everything from finding aids only, and I'd get a result something like this. You can see that the part of statement then gives you the full path, so you know exactly where you are once you find this result set. And you can also click here, and that takes you to the finding aid at the exact location where that path came from. I'd be happy to have you contact me if you have any questions that we can't cover today or if you have any comments. You may also want to explore the EAD example that I gave you, the Brigham Young office file collection. There's a URL for it, or you can use the QR code. Thank you.
Well, it looks like we have about 10 minutes left, so we'd be willing to have you ask questions if you've got any. I guess. He asked for us to put the last slide back up. Yes, we will. That was an easy question, by the way. Thank you. Go ahead, Scott.
Almost all of the participation has been focused on the human story model being pushed outside of the archives environment to reach out to the larger archives, including the blog approach, is interesting. How many others have been working with communities outside of the archives to gather information that then can be brought into the system to interpret it to enhance
That is a great question. I hope I can effectively restate it in the microphone. Scott noticed that most of the presentations that were given focused on ways in which we've enhanced archival descriptions internally by partnering with people internal to the organization. He's wondering if there are things that we have done with user groups outside of our internal focus to help enhance descriptions. Did I get that right, Scott? All right, panelists.
Did you have like history professors that you were working with?
Not yet.
Okay. Anyone?
I'll take a crack at it. The answer is not yet. I think we need to build good, solid, and well-performing platforms, and then we can take the next step and open things up to crowdsourcing. Is that what you're talking about? Because I think we need to have something that really works very well so that you can locate things, and then you can make it possible for people to use those tools to take the next step to go into, to ask for help of our audience to do crowdsourcing. If that's not what you're talking about, I'll try another answer. We have a very good group in our organization that do interactive design, and they brought in a lot of our customers to help us design what we have here. And since it's gone public with a few finding aids, not very many so far, we've had so far very, very good positive results. So that's another way of reaching into our audience, but in a way it's really kind of helping us to improve the product in the first place. Does that answer your question?
Not entirely, yes. Maybe I can use blog as a means to gather additional information to enhance descriptions currently. My question
That's you.
To you is in terms of
So Scott's specifically probably asking Holly about how she had used a blog to try and get people who may have more expertise in certain subject areas that were being described by the internally, but they would be external to the organization and they could provide some of that feedback.
Unfortunately, I'm not any longer at Haskell, which is where most of our commenters contacted us. But we did actually get a lot of people who I think didn't come to the blog looking for funding needs, but came because they were interested in the topic. And they would constantly write, I knew the person who created these records, and you have this wrong. You know, they were actually involved in X before they were involved in Y. And we always took, we did a little research to make sure that was accurate, but there was no way for us, at the speed that we were working, to always have everything exactly right. So we really relied on their input and always tried to make sure that any revisions that were accurate were added to the findings as soon as possible.
Sounds good. Any other questions? If not, we'll get out of here early, I guess. Thank you very much for your attendance. We appreciate it.
That's surprising.